The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Candidate Hugh Hewitt. I am on my way back from Wyoming. I'll tell you about it tomorrow on the Thursday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. But Ed Morrissey is up from the great state of Texas sitting in today. He'll be able to fill you in on what he's been thinking and writing about over at Hot Air. And he's got quite a few thoughts, and I hope you've been reading Hot Air to see what he has been saying. For usual, Ed is basically, I'm mind-melded with Ed, and Ed is mind-melded with me. It's the Catholic thing. Take it away, Ed Morrissey, and thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I am Ed Morrissey, coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studios here in Central Texas. And Hugh and I are mind-melded. Our Catholicism mind-melds us, which leads me to our first major disclosure today. I am actually open carrying a high-capacity assault rosary. A 3.16 caliber, as Dwayne put it earlier today. So, you know, just so that you know, full disclosure, carrying the assault rosary. We're going to be talking about that with Catherine Jean Lopez and Dan McLaughlin later on in the show. We've actually got some great guests lined up, and hope you're going to be sticking with us for the whole 3 hours. But of course, the top story today is coming from Wyoming, where Liz Cheney is now Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant all rolled up into one. For losing a primary election. Wait a minute. Let me check my notes on that. Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses Grant for losing a primary election. Dwayne, these notes are terrible, Dwayne. How is Liz Cheney, Abraham Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant for losing a primary election?
Well, as our friend Kurt Schlichter said on Twitter last night, after she compared herself to Grant, he said, well, at least Grant served. You know, it just I think we talked about a little bit ago off air, which is that concession speech is largely a good example of why she lost.
It really is. I mean, this is part of the sort of the Beltway Obsession lecture series, I guess, that Liz Cheney has been on for the past year and a half. I mean, almost the entire term that she's been sort of focused on this. And it's because January 6th, of course, took place at the very start of the term. So, I mean, that's part of what's going on here. But this is a person who's clearly lost touch with Wyoming. She is fully invested in what's going on in the Beltway, and Wyoming voters got a chance to weigh in on it yesterday.
The takeaway is Wyoming voters don't care about the 1-6 committee. They want to know about inflation. They want to know about, you know, the same issues that everybody else cares about. And she doesn't seem to give any voice to normal issues. There's only one issue with her, right? And they just got tired of it.
Now, they're going to, I mean, certainly Liz Cheney painted it this way last night in her concession speech, that, you know, she doesn't want to stand down from fighting Donald Trump. And this was a proxy battle between her and Donald Trump. And Harriet Hageman, who's the new presumed representative from Wyoming, because Republicans don't usually lose that seat, did align herself with Donald Trump, but she wasn't always a Donald Trump person. She's not necessarily a knee-jerk Donald Trump acolyte. You know, in 2016, she was part of the floor effort, and this is something that, by the way, Eli Yokley pointed out this morning, earlier this morning. Eli Yokley from Morning Consult Political also had been at Roll Call. Which was that she was part of the floor effort in 2016 to force a nomination vote that was strictly between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz in a last ditch effort to wrest the nomination away from Donald Trump. People may not remember this. This was a sort of a rules committee fight in the Republican National Convention in 2016, but it did take place. And Hageman was part of that. So she's not exactly necessarily a full-fledged acolyte of Donald Trump. But
there you go, trying to bring up facts again. Facts are the last thing that this election was
about.
Well,
I mean, it's Actually, it is. It is about facts. It's about the fact that inflation is running high. It's about the fact that the Biden administration is imposing policies, especially in energy, but also land use policies that are very damaging to Wyoming residents. And they're very unhappy about that. And they only got one person in the House to fight for them. And that person is busy working for Nancy Pelosi.
Yes.
On the January 6th committee. I mean, this is not what this is not exactly political science, you know, 600 here. When you are a House representative, you know you're going to be in front of your voters every 2 years, which means that you have to be responsive to your voters pretty much every day that you're in office in order to make sure that you secure your seat. And when you're not responsive to, in fact, when you're entirely unresponsive to the issues that really matter to them, and you're completely focused on political infighting in Washington, D.C., you're likely not to win your primary election. That's exactly what happened in Wyoming last night. We should probably, though, give Liz Cheney a chance to offer her thoughts on this. So let's go to cut number 16 and listen to Liz Cheney explain why she did what she did.
The great and original champion of our party, Abraham Lincoln, was defeated in elections for the Senate and the House before he won the most important election of all. Lincoln ultimately prevailed. He saved our union, and he defined our obligation as Americans for all of history. Speaking at Gettysburg of the great task remaining before us, Lincoln said that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. As we meet here tonight, that remains our greatest and most important task. Most of world history is a story of violent conflict, of servitude and suffering. Most people in most places have not lived in freedom. Our American freedom is a providential departure from history. We are the exception. We have been given the gift of freedom by God and our founding fathers. It has been said that the long arc of history bends toward justice and freedom. That's true, but only if we make it bend. Today, our highest duty is to bend the arc of history, to preserve our nation and its blessings, to ensure that freedom will not perish, to protect the very foundations of this constitutional republic.
You know, the Ken Burns music is perfect here.
Yes.
Ken Burns music playing underneath that concession speech of sorts. I'm not even sure you call it a concession speech. It's more of a valediction, I think, is what we're listening to.
It was, you know, it was the launch of a, what did she say? Lincoln lost, you know, his House and Senate seat before winning, you know, the ultimate seat. She's signaling right out of the box that she's going to run for president.
In what universe is she going to run for president?
The I hate Trump universe.
Well, I mean, even if you concede the fact that, you know, there's actually, you know, quite a few people who might rally to that point, right? I mean, who's going to rally to Liz Cheney on that issue? There are other politicians that aren't named Cheney. I mean, I'm not sure what she thinks the brand of Cheney is in American politics, but it is not a rugged libertarian viewpoint. This is the Cheneys are pretty famously neocons that Democrats actually detest unless they can use them for their own purposes.
That's exactly right. I mean,
I like Dick Cheney. I
adore the Cheneys.
I think he was a good vice president. Like anybody else, I think he made some mistakes. But I think he was overall a good vice president, smart guy, smart as a whip, been around forever, really knows his stuff. And simply put, he was the prince of darkness in American politics, popular American politics.
The fact that the Cheney brand has now been redeemed in the eyes of all people left of center. It's never going to happen.
Yeah, it's only momentarily.
It's only transactional when talking about Trump. That's right. The only time that they will tolerate the Cheneys.
Right. And the New York Times, I think, was right. This is the launch of a national campaign. She thinks that she's going to even if it's not a run for president, I think she's going to run a national campaign for, you know, truth, honor, and justice in politics, which would be great if you didn't have the baggage of the name Cheney on you. But
instead of Lincoln and Grant, she should have compared herself to Moses. You know, I I'm compelled to do. I mean, that's what she's going to do.
I think so. Yeah, I think that. Well, don't put it past her. Anybody who gets a 38-point shellacking in a primary election and then compares herself to Lincoln and Grant.
In a Wyoming Republican primary, she didn't even get 30% of the vote.
She did not get 30% of the vote. Well, we'll be back with the next chapter of Ken Burns' documentary in Wyoming after a few commercial spots that you didn't hear on NPR. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh Hewitt. We'll be right back. Studios here in Central Texas, and the Catholic thing is indeed what we're going to be talking about with our next guest, my friend Catherine Jean Lopez. And Catherine Jean, I certainly hope that you have your rosary out. I have my assault grade high capacity 59 bead cylinder rosary in my hand as I speak, as I'm sure you do as well.
Well, you know, the amazing thing about that Atlantic piece, Ed, is that the rosary is the best weapon we have, you know, to combat evil. Prayer is real. It's action. And so inadvertently, the author of that Atlantic piece caught on to something. I do have to say, though, there is something that very much worries me about this. As someone who prays the rosary outside of Planned Parenthood in Manhattan regularly, one thing I noticed, so the first Saturday of every month, there is a Witness for Life outside Planned Parenthood in Manhattan. And this, for the first time, I saw signs that said, don't pray here, pray inside. You know, usually it's like God loves abortion and things like this.
Right.
But we see in Ireland right now, they're trying to make it illegal to pray outside of an abortion clinic. Again, inadvertently, I think people realize it actually is a threat.
I think, by the way, I should make sure that I introduce you properly as a National Review contributor, nationalreview.com, and certainly somebody I have enjoyed talking with about politics and certainly about faith. You know, and I kind of
like
joke.
Two decades now, Ed.
I know, exactly.
Yeah, we go way back,
and I'm very blessed that we go way back. But I wrote this response to the Atlantic piece, and you know, I was alternating between high dudgeon and, you know, sort of low comedy, because this is on one level such a ridiculous attack on what is a very gentle and contemplative prayer process. And, you know, I've been joking around about carrying a high capacity assault rosary ever since that piece appeared at the Atlantic. But, you know, I'll be honest with you, I'm a dilettante on the rosary. I really am. I mean, my wife is the prayer warrior, right? So, we've been teasing each other about how she's a concealed carry, a concealed rosary carrier. But she's really the prayer warrior, and she has done exactly what you are talking about: prayed the rosary outside of abortion clinics. And I think that you're right about this, and that there is a more malicious intent here to radicalize people against the rosary. And we can talk about that on a temporal level. We can also talk about that on a spiritual level. But on the temporal level, I think it is to try to marginalize people of faith who are acting on that faith in public, and especially in terms of opposing policies that the left is, you know, I mean, sacramentalized. I mean, this, Daniel Panetton's talking about, well, you know, they're sacramentalizing guns. I've never heard anybody sacramentalize guns, but Democrats have sacramentalized abortion. And that is, I think, really what this is about. I think you put your finger right on it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we have seen in recent years attacks on religious freedom where you're only supposed to be in a place of worship, right?
Right.
There's a danger, and they're right, you know? There's a danger to living faith out in the world, you know? That's what we're supposed to do. And it is, you know, a threat to evil, and abortion is evil, you know? And the more we see just attacks on reality, it's not a surprise that this supernatural weapon would be seen as a threat. But I love what you said, Ed, about the tenderness of this. You know, I mean, the rosary is a prayer that the Mother of God leads us on, meditating on the life of Christ. And there can be nothing so grounding as that, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, no, my prayer is that this attack leads to more people praying the rosary, more people understanding what it is. You know, this could be a blessing in disguise.
It could be. And again, we're speaking with Catherine Jean Lopez, NationalReview.com contributor, and talking about this article in The Atlantic, which, you know, The Atlantic has just become sort of the depository of garbage hot takes anyway. But this one was really something. I mean,
no, it was a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, and it was right after, 2 days after, the same magazine ran another hot take that the issue with Jane's Revenge targeting pro-life facilities for terrorist attacks, which was literally happening, and they were literally taking credit for, was actually secondary to the fact that Republicans were pouncing on that for political gain. And I mean, it just the cognitive dissonance between these two articles.
How dare people be offended by attacks on centers that literally help women, you know?
Right.
Which, honestly, we should all be able to get behind, you know?
Right.
And the other amazing thing about the Atlantic piece on the Rosary was it came out on the Feast of the Assumption, the greatest Marian feast day.
Yeah, I actually had missed that, and a number of people pointed it out to me. It was like, well, I'm not going to go back and add that in, but you're right. It's really an interesting juxtaposition. I'm sure that no one at the Atlantic knew about the feast day. I'm absolutely convinced that nobody there knows enough about Catholicism to know that.
Yeah, no, considering they thought the rosary was one of the seven sacraments.
Right.
That's probably safe to assume.
If you don't know the difference between a sacrament and a sacramental, maybe you shouldn't be commenting on this particular thing. But, you know, I mean, the other thing, too, and, you know, I may not be the best at praying the rosary, but it's a beautiful prayer. Normally, when Catholics get criticized for it, it's because, outside critics will say it's too focused on the feminine. Right. And you have the Atlantic arguing that it's a masculine warrior based prayer tradition. And I'm thinking, maybe the prayer to Saint Michael the Archangel is what you're talking about, not the Rosary. I mean, this really is. It's such a gentle meditative prayer that it just seems astonishing that anybody would single it out for that for criticism as being extremist. And I'll let you take it from there.
Well, in so many ways, though, it doesn't surprise me. I remember one morning standing outside of Planned Parenthood in Manhattan, and I had my rosary in my hand, and a woman came by and said, "Put it away!" Like, that's how she sounded. And I thought, of all the things that are happening in Manhattan right now, this is the greatest threat, really? But maybe it is, you know? I just think that Atlantic Peace is such a reminder to us that prayer is actually powerful, and that someone would see it as such a threat to write that piece should be a reminder to us that we better be praying the rosary every day, you know?
Indeed, indeed. And it should be a reminder to us that people who are activists are looking for any symbology that they can apply to their opponents and to radicalize it and make it extreme and demagogue on it in order to silence them, Catherine Jean. And I think that that's really the big lesson here. I think that's exactly what the Atlantic was trying to do here.
Yeah, that is definitely my fear. The one thing I'll say, though, to pro-lifers to be cautious of is I feel this every time I'm in front of Planned Parenthood in New York. People think we're judging them. Don't have that kind of attitude. Be gentle, like the rosary is.
Like the rosary is. Catherine Jean Lopez, NationalReview.com. Thank you so much for being here. Where disco lives forever, from the ReliefFactor.com studios here in Central Texas. Joining us now is Dan McLaughlin from National Review Online, NationalReview.com, senior writer there. We're going to talk a couple of issues with Dan. First off, Dan, I read with great interest your piece on the Atlantic's juxtaposition of their Rosaries Are Extremist piece, along with the Republicans pounce on an actual terrorist group, and that's a bad thing piece, within literally 2 days of each other, Dan. That was it's a great piece that you have up, brief and devastating. What do you make of what's become of the Atlantic over the last year or so?
Thanks. Glad to be here, Ed. It's really nuts. I think what you have is, I mean, first of all, the Atlantic, which again, like a lot of these legacy outlets, it does still produce a good deal of good content.
Right.
But there's this kind of creeping paranoia there that, and clickbait, I guess. But, you know, they have to constantly build up threats from the right. We remember the famous headline where they referred to reopening the state of Georgia early on in the COVID pandemic as Georgia's experiment in human sacrifice.
Yes.
So this is in the same vein as that, right? So they, on the one hand, they have to stretch and say, there's this piece, extremist gun culture co-opted the rosary, and so they're trying to paint, some of your typical just very online yahoos, some of whom may be dangerous, some of whom may not be, but, you know, they're no different than any other kind of nutty corner of the internet, you know, using the imagery of the rosary beads along with, you know, guns.
Right.
And they're like, oh, this is, you know, this how this is. They're bringing a sacrament of their own to the AR-15 sacred object movement, which, first of all, any Catholics who are listening will be chortling at the concept of the rosary as a sacrament.
Right.
And that it's kind of shocking that nobody at the magazine picked that up. You would think you don't even need a Catholic. You just need like some ex-Catholic, somebody who made it through like the third grade who could tell you there are seven sacraments. This ain't one of them. But at the same time, they do this piece on the Jane's Revenge group that has carried out like actual firebombings. Like, these are actual terrorists, and probably if they keep this up, sooner or later they will kill somebody.
Right.
We know that from the history of groups that tried to do bombings, property bombings. Sooner or later that goes further. Think of the Weathermen.
Exactly.
So, you know, but when they're discussing Jane's Revenge, their angle is all like Republicans pounce, right? It's the right's new bogeymen, right-wing activists and politicians are eating it up. Well, maybe the problem is the people doing the firebombings, not the people getting worried about it.
But you think?
You know, they see They're incapable of having a symmetrical response to threats, right? So the mere imagery of the rosary with the gun to them is terrifying, whereas the actual reality of firebombings is not.
Well, you know, Dan, I think that there's something to that. I think there's more to it, though, than that. In a couple directions. One is that it's just downright sloppy to say, well, somebody who has got thousands of followers has somehow got more impact on the imagery of the rosary than hundreds of millions of Catholics who use it every single day around the world is laughable to anybody who's got thousands of followers themselves on social media. You don't even have to be Catholic to understand that that's a really dumb argument, right? I've got 63,000 followers on Twitter, and I'm pretty sure that I have not made Die Hard not a Christmas movie. I mean, I'm not going to concede that it is, but I'm just saying that my years-long campaign against that idea is not exactly successful, Dan. And regardless of how many thousands of followers I have, again, we're talking with Dan McLaughlin, senior writer at nationalreview.com. So on one hand, it's just sloppy, but I think the other part of this is that they're setting this up to sort of box in people by taking their normal everyday symbology and making it toxic. And, you know, especially when it comes to religion, because the left feels threatened by people of faith. And I think that there's more to this than just a stupid analyst and a completely ignorant editorial staff. I think that there's something a little bit more intentional and malicious about this.
Yeah, and it is part of the overall trend that, that I think is going to drive our politics to be divided along religious lines more and more in the future, which frankly, I think the left's happy place, what has worked for them politically, is to have politics divided along racial lines. I think division along religious lines, which is unhealthy in its own way, but is probably less of a winning political division for them.
Well, I think you're right about that. I think that that's a real losing proposition, and I guess we'll see. But we'll see how this plays out. I do want to get to another piece that you wrote at National Review about what's going on in the Manhattan DA's office with Alan Weisselberg, because you and I took a look at the news that the New York Times broke. I would say, was it yesterday afternoon or was it the night before? The New York Times broke the news that Alan Weisselberg, who's, of course, the long time, I guess he's a CFO of Trump Organization. He's the top ranking money guy in the organization, is going to cut a deal which is going to land him less than 100 days in jail, all told. But he's not going to provide any evidence against Donald Trump. So to me, normally a plea deal with a figure like Weisselberg would normally signal that the prosecutor's case is really starting to develop. In this case, it looks like the prosecutors are just really throwing in the towel and want to get this thing over with and get it off their plate.
Yeah, and my colleague Andy McCarthy, who is an ex-prosecutor, talks about this has talked about the same kind of trend that you've seen sometimes with the Mueller investigation and the the Durham investigation as well. Like, typically if you're rolling up comparatively minor figures in an investigation and they're not pleading guilty to a conspiracy or something, if they're not pleading in a way that obviously indicates that they're testifying against and pointing the finger at somebody else, that probably means the investigation's losing momentum rather than gaining it. And I think it's clear that, the special prosecutors and the other senior people who are already assigned to this case have been, resigned or reassigned. So I think it seems pretty clear that Bragg is just, Alvin Bragg, the DA there, is just closing up shop. And saying, look, I've poured enough money and manpower into investigating Donald Trump and I'm done.
Well, and first off, I would encourage people to go to nationalreview.com and read Dan McLaughlin's analysis of this, because you delve deeply into this and talk about why this case was probably a loser from the get-go, which was that the types of things that they wanted to prove weren't really crimes. They may not be great business practices. There may be some ethical issues involved, but they're not really crimes. And that was part of what the problem with this case was under Cyrus Vance. And now that Alvin Bragg's in office, I think kind of surprisingly, Alvin Bragg may have decided that this was not a great way to kick off his career as a Manhattan DA.
Yeah, and I mean, look, Bragg is on the one hand a progressive who obviously, you know, loathes Trump and his base loathes Trump. But on the other hand, he is one of the sort of classic progressive prosecutor types who sees things from a defense perspective more than your typical prosecutor does. And I think he didn't want to shoot at Trump and miss, and right. He didn't want to waste a ton of his resources on this. So, the original theory, they were going to say, well, you know, they looked into the Trump Organization's finances, which presumably included a lot of kind of puffery of exactly how much Trump's properties are worth. But Trump doesn't have, you know, it's a private company. He doesn't have shareholders.
Right.
The banks that loaned him money got paid back. So where's the harm here? Who's the victim? And the closest they could ever come up with was, well, you kind of cheated the tax man.
Yeah, not necessarily something that a jury, even in Manhattan, will probably care a lot about. I think that's you'd have to have a pretty bulletproof case to put that in front of a jury. And clearly they weren't getting it from Alan Weisselberg, and I'm not sure who else they would have been able to get it from.
Yeah, I think it's important to stress here that the issue here was the tax treatment of Weisselberg's own compensation. So right. It was not, you know, they were not able to prove sort of a major tax evasion case on the part of the organization. The issue was specifically just with the kind of thing that it was easy to imagine that Trump would have just left this to Weisselberg.
So, I mean, this is interesting in the context of what's been going on over the last week or so with Donald Trump, too. I mean, you talk about Alvin Bragg was cautious about having to do a swing and a miss against Trump. I mean, we can also talk about the raid here, and that same risk was taken by Merrick Garland. Got about 30 seconds. I'll just let you respond to this really quickly, Dan McLaughlin. I mean, that's the risk that Garland ran here, too, with the raid, right?
Yeah, and look, at the end of the day, both Trump and the people pursuing him have existed over and over again in this gray area where the law doesn't quite reach Trump, but it doesn't quite put him in the clear. We're on uncharted ground time and time again.
Dan McLaughlin, senior writer at nationalreview.com. You can find him on Twitter at baseballcrank, by the way. He's a great Twitter follow. You should follow him on Twitter at baseballcrank. I'm Ed Morrissey of hotair.com. We'll be right back.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of hotair.com from the relieffactor.com studios in Central Texas. Joining us now is Brian Westbury, senior economist, First Trust Portfolios at Westbury on Twitter. Brian, great to talk to you today. I want to ask you about this Inflation Reduction Act that Joe Biden signed last night, and now Democrats are describing as anything but an Inflation Reduction Act. What can we expect out of this bill? Because clearly inflation reduction isn't one of them.
Yeah, Ed, it is great to be with you, and you are absolutely right. What I don't get is why they still keep calling it this, because I have finally decided that politicians just think everybody is stupid. Like right. They're going to keep saying it over and over again, as if you can look me in the eye and tell me red is blue and I'm going to believe you. And so this obviously will not raise a lower inflation at all. I look at this bill and I count my lucky stars, right? Because they wanted to push the individual tax rate up to 39.6, the capital gains tax rate that high, corporate taxes to 28. They wanted to tax carried interest and a step-up basis after you died for your inheritance. And so the bottom line is we this is Build Back Better light, double light.
Right.
And so that's good. But on the other side, it's just more growth in government. It's just not as much as they wanted. And when you have a bigger government, you end up with slower growth in productivity and entrepreneurship, and that leads to more inflation in the long run than you would have had otherwise.
Well, not just more inflation, but slower growth, right? I mean, we kind of went through this in 2009 with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, right?
Yeah.
Where there was this massive 800 and something billion dollar stimulus package that was passed in order to help right the economy at the same time that the Obama administration was putting in place all sorts of different anti-growth policies, including on energy production, by the way, as well. And what ended up, the only reason why we end up coming out of that is because the Fed went on a monetary expansion binge for several years in order to make money cheap enough so that you could get enough capital investment to keep the economy going. And we're paying for that now. That's part of the structural, it's part of the infrastructure, if you will, of the inflationary wave that we've got right now. And it's the reason why the Fed is starting to act quickly to tamp it down, is because they need to get all of that excess monetary supply out of the system, if they can. But so now we've got the worst of the both worlds in 2009. You've got the Fed cracking down on monetary supply, and you've got government spending and expanded regulation. So even apart from the inflation question, what you're talking about here is probably not just slow growth, but no growth, and possibly spending our way into a recession here.
Yeah. I do believe we will see a recession in 2023, probably. Maybe we make it all the way to 2024, although I don't think so. And a lot of it's because of exactly what you just described. It is going to be a stagflationary type of recessionary period
right.
of time. That is the slow growth with higher inflation. And then we have to see what happens, because politicians in D.C., a recession comes, and don't kid yourself, the Fed is our Jerome Powell is a politician. That's, he's got to convince everybody that he can do this. But if a recession comes, he's going to end up cutting rates, and then you don't get rid of inflation. And that's exactly what happened in the 70s. Every time we had a recession, the Fed got easier, and inflation was more deeply seeded into the economy. And then finally, it was Volcker who made the recession last. And we actually had two recessions under Volcker.
Right.
But he had to make it long enough and deep enough to kill the inflation.
And the longer you wait on that, by the way, the worse it has to be when you finally get around
that's
to that
exactly
policy.
Right.
And,
yep.
I mean, one last thing here. You've got we've only got about 30 seconds. We've had five straight quarters of declining, literally declining real disposable personal income, which is the reason why it feels like a recession to so many people. Five straight quarters where real income has declined. How is that impacting people's investments, and what should they do? I know it's a complex question. Got about maybe 20 seconds to answer it. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, just. First of all, I wouldn't argue that weird things aren't going on, that people aren't hurting. It's a strange time. But one of the reasons it's five straight quarters is because included in those incomes is all the checks from the government.
Right.
And we stopped. And so that's confusing people. They don't know whether to go get a job or not.
Well, Brian Westbury, you can find him on Twitter at Westbury, W-E-S-B-U-R-Y. So follow him. Hugh Hewitt's intensely smart audience. And that's the reason why I like to bring on intensely smart people to discuss things that are going on. Joining me right now, another one of my good friends, Jim Garrity from National Review, who is also keeping a close eye on all of the political developments of the day. And of course, Jim, today, the big story is what happened in Wyoming and what a great shock this wasn't.
Ed, morning, Grace. I'm kind of surprised that it took an entire, you know, was it 30 minutes to announce
that?
I think it was Decision Desk that initially called it, and everybody else. I mean, we kind of knew the handwriting on the wall for this was a long while back. I think this was obvious really going back to the beginning of the year when it became clear Liz Cheney had taken this outspoken position, critical of Trump, and that she was not going to modify it. She was not going to downplay it. She was not going to focus on Wyoming issues. And, you know, she had put out her flag. She drew a line in the sand. I think there's something very admirable about that when you say, I don't care if my constituents feel differently. This is a matter of right and wrong, not right and left. And I'm drawing my line in the sand. And if defeat is the consequence, I'll accept it. And somebody that's very admirable. Americans say they want somebody who isn't just going to be a weather vane and is going to be principled right up until the moment they actually get it. They're usually like, well, I didn't mean it that way. You know, no, I meant you should do what we want you to do on that issue. What I was just talking about with Dwayne, though, and I'm kind of baffled by, is I've seen a lot of people like, well, you know, she's defeated, but she's more powerful than ever. And I'm sitting there scratching my head and saying, really? Yeah. This sets her up to be the next Mark Sanford or Joe Walsh or Evan McMullen.
Evan McMullen, very much an Evan McMullen, if Evan McMullen had ever won office in the first place. I mean,
he's a de facto Democratic Senate candidate out in Utah. I keep hearing Democrats thinking he's going to win against Mike Lee. I'm very skeptical of that because it's Utah and it's a good year for Republicans, but I suppose stranger things have happened.
Well, Jim, I mean, I think you're onto something here, but I want to just step back a little bit into some of the things that you were saying, because among the things that you were saying there, I think is really what created this wide gulf, and clearly it's a very wide gulf between Liz Cheney and her constituents in Wyoming, which was not that she was anti-Trump. There's other anti-Trump Republicans who've managed to hang on to their offices. But it's the fact that she's really dedicated the entire session of Congress, this entire term in office, to investigating Trump and doing nothing else and not doing any of the normal constituent service type thing. I mean, I'm sure that she answers, her office answers emails from people who are having problems with, you know, the bureaucracy and tries to help them struggle through that. I'm not talking about that type of personal constituent service, but I'm talking about focusing on issues that matter. And my friend Kelly Maher, I think you know Kelly.
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah. And she emailed me this morning or late last night because she was so frustrated over some of the commentary on this. And she said the difference in this race is that Harriet Hageman was going out into all the different places in Wyoming and talking about issues like land use, like water use, like inflation, overregulation, the Biden administration's environmental policies, all these things that really detrimentally impact Wyoming voters and are very much on their mind in the present, while Liz Cheney is talking about what happened in the past and nothing, and exclusively that. And Wyoming only has one representative in the House. This is a statewide election because it's an at-large seat. And I think that Hageman really understood that Wyoming voters were tired of having no representation in the House, basically, for any of their concerns. If they had four other representatives, you know, like a smaller state like a Nevada or like a, or even like a Utah, where you could have three or four members, you know, pursuing those issues, and you had one member doing, you know, going off on their own and, you know, off to be alone in her principles, and in the from that great line from That Thing You Do, the movie That Thing You Do. There he goes, off to go write his new hit song, I'm Alone in My Principles. I think that voters might not have been so unhappy with Cheney, but she's their only representative in the House, and she's not representing them.
You know, if you look at a Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, who is looking pretty darn good in his odds against Abrams in a re-election, you know, the Kemp approach was, you know, Trump is mad at me, but I'm not mad at Trump. And let me tell you about what we're doing here in Georgia to protect the vote. remember how Major League Baseball took away the All-Star game because allegedly we were suppressing the vote, and now look how big the vote is. I'm just standing here for my conservative values. And you know, and Purdue got no traction against that. It was a really surprisingly lopsided response. I don't know if that exact scenario could have worked for Liz Cheney. But I think she very clearly decided. For most people, it's like, look, if you think I'm wrong on Trump, I'm sorry to hear that. But here's other issues that I work on your behalf, and I hope you'll like them. And that worked very well for Brian Kemp. Also, I think the prospect of Governor Stacey Abrams may have convinced a whole bunch of Georgia Republicans to say, nah, we're not going to change horses in the middle of the stream. We don't, you know. And also, by the way, the other thing is that Trump at one point made what might have been a semi-joking comment, but he kind of suggested that Stacey Abrams wouldn't be that bad. And I think that was a bridge too far for Georgia Republicans to even consider that, well, we're so mad at Brian Kemp for not, you know, rigging the election for Trump, or for not, you know, finding the 10,000 votes that Trump had demanded and all that kind of stuff. We're so mad at him, we're willing to accept Stacey Abrams. Trump may be willing to accept that, but the typical Georgia Republican is not.
Right.
And so, you know, if Liz Cheney had said, well, sorry, you disagree with me on Trump, but let me show you all these other. And the irony is, Liz Cheney has this 90-some% conservative voting record.
Right.
By no stretch of the imagination can you genuinely argue she's a liberal, she's a progressive, she's a rhino sellout, et cetera, et cetera. That's one of the ironies of watching all of these Democrats to say, well, I never thought I'd, you know, be applauding someone named Cheney, but, you know, and who's doing these sorts of things. The other thing that is very clear about this is how utterly transactional the praise of the left of center, you know, media voices and Democrats and things like that is, because, you know, let's say she had won the primary, and the moment she turned around and started making actual conservative arguments, people would go back to denouncing her as the blood spawn of the horrific bloodthirsty warmonger, et cetera, et cetera. When I keep going back, you know, one of my favorite questions or sayings is from Stephen Covey, saying, begin with the end in mind, right? You know, think
right.
about what your actual final objective is and kind of work backward from there about what you want to do. And I don't really get what Liz Cheney's goal is. I mean, I know she says she wants to stop Trump from being elected again. And to me, the best way to do that is, all right, then you need somebody like a Ron DeSantis type to beat Trump in the Republican primary.
Right.
You need to have, you know, the Republicans might be willing and ready to be a post-Trump party. They are not ready and willing to be an anti-Trump party. And this talk that she's going to run for president in 2024, either in a long-shot primary challenge against Trump, again, she turns into Joe Walsh, she turns into Mark Sanford, or this idea that she'll run for president as an independent, like, that's just splitting the anti-Trump vote.
Right.
None of that makes any sense. I'm kind of sitting there thinking, what does she actually want to do here? Unless the goal is just to be a really big star, beloved by MSNBC and CNN and places like that.
And NBC, because she was on NBC this morning talking about, well, I might or might not. I'm not sure what I'm going to do about the presidential race after comparing herself to Lincoln and Grant last night in her concession or semi-concession speech, I guess you could say. Her valediction, at least. And so, yeah, I mean, clearly she's aiming at that sort of thing. But once you've lost a statewide election in a state like Wyoming, you don't have a lot of credibility left. I got about 30 seconds left for you, Jim Garrity.
Yeah, so let's say she does it. Let's say she doubles the William Weld vote from 2020. That's 4%. If she maybe she does a reasonable level in like New Hampshire. And when I say a reasonable level, I mean like 20%, right? Again, if you are a conservative who has not been anti-Trump, like Ron DeSantis, but who also is saying, look, I'm the post-Trump, I give you all the policy stuff you want and none of the circus, I think that works a heck of a lot better than anything Cheney's trying.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Jim Garrity, at Jim Garrity on Twitter. NationalReview.com is where you find his commentary.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Welcome back. This is Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com filling in for Hugh Hewitt today from the ReliefFactor.com studios in Central Texas. Joining me now is Professor Jonathan Adler, Case Western Reserve Law Professor, as well as contributor to Reason.com's Volokh Conspiracy. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Hillary rule with Jonathan. First off, welcome to the show. Thanks for jumping in here.
Great to be here.
So the Hillary rule, we have esteemed attorneys on really the far ends of the Trump spectrum, right? You got Alan Dershowitz, who is basically been spending his recent career defending or representing Trump in a lot of different debates, not, you know, and sometimes officially, as he did in the impeachment trial. But and then you got David French, who is very much against Trump. But both of them are saying the same thing, Jonathan, which is that the Department of Justice has to follow its own precedent in dealing with any sort of issues regarding mishandling of classified information. And those precedents were set in 2016 by the FBI and the Department of Justice by default, actually, by letting James Comey dictate policy, which is that there's all sorts of different conditions under which the Department of Justice won't move on any sorts of allegations. What is your read of actually what the Hillary rule actually is, and how closely you expect Merrick Garland to abide by it?
Well, I mean, my understanding of the Hillary rule is actually two pieces. One, there's a different rule for high profile folks than there is for, you may remember the case of Christian Saucier, naval officer who was prosecuted for photos he took on a submarine that he was stationed on, that because of what they were photos of contained national defense information covered by the Espionage Act, and he was prosecuted, even though it's pretty clear he was not engaged in any sort of espionage or skullduggery. And he was not did not have the sort of willfulness or underhanded activity that Comey says is required for a high profile person like Hillary Clinton. So, assuming that Trump is in the normal folk category, but in the high profile category that Hillary was in, the requirement is something that evidences bad faith. That evidence is an effort to obstruct something more willful. I would note that there is some language in some of the relevant statutes that suggests that should be the standard, at least for some of the potential offenses. And I hope and I think that the Justice Department will apply a similar standard before prosecuting. I hope as well that the primary aim of the warrant was to obtain and secure what is alleged to be a national defense information, which is covered by various statutes and which is the sort of sensitive information that the federal government typically does not want floating around out there and does not want in the hands of former officials. But of course, we don't know. And we also, unfortunately, have to take press reports about coming out of the FBI or the Department of Justice with a little bit of grain of salt, because we've learned in recent years that we may not be getting the whole picture. So I hope that they're going to apply a same standard, I think, as a political matter. And as you know, I am no Trump fan. I was on the opposite side of Alan Dershowitz on impeachment.
Right.
But for political reasons, and given the partisan divide in the countries, I certainly hope the Justice Department is going to be consistent and only take action if there is evidence of the sort of willful misconduct that we did not see, or at least James Comey did not see in the Hillary Clinton context.
Well, and I mean, there was a lot to unpack in the Hillary Clinton context, too, because, you know, if Trump took classified materials and stored them in an unsecured or insufficiently secured facility, that's definitely a violation of the Espionage Act statutes. I mean, I used to work in a defense contractor, and I had security clearances for lower level classified material, and I know very well how that stuff is supposed to be secured, even at those levels. And I wasn't dealing with top secret or compartmented information. So if that information existed, then there was a risk of exposure, and that's exactly what the Espionage Act is intended to prevent. But sure. there's a couple of differences here, even in that. First off, what's being alleged is that Donald Trump took this stuff and stuck them in Mar-a-Lago in some sort of, storage unit at Mar-a-Lago, to presumably so he could pore over them and do his memoirs at some point, or just simply have them handy so that he had exclusive access to them. Hillary Clinton transmitted them over an unsecured server that made them very, very susceptible to penetration by hostile forces, and did it for 4 years. And the existence of that server was arguably, the use of that server was intended to give her an opportunity not to comply with the normal records processes at the State Department. She was doing it to bypass those checks and balances, and that makes that a little bit more of a malicious act. At least that may not be an objective viewpoint, but certainly there is a lot more intent that that one can argue when it comes to Hillary. So these cases are not necessarily even analogous yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, I share those concerns about the server. I mean, I do think that given how conveniently so many things and records and the like were destroyed, whether or not proving what you and I both suspect were the reasons for having the server in the first place, I think it would have been hard to prove that in a prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt. Although, someone in her situation should not have set something like that up by accident or and the like. Here, we don't really. The first reality is we don't know, right? We have what's been reported in the press. How much confidence we have in that at this point?
Right.
No, we do have what's been released. We do know what statutes are cited. I think if I was going to play devil's advocate for Trump, I would say, he believes, I think, that while as president, he can declassify whatever he wants, which is certainly true. Although, since it's information that's technically classified, not a document,
right?
You can't just say, well, because I have it, it's declassified. But I think he, proving that he deliberately and knowingly was violating statutes would be hard up until the point, as alleged, that he was told to return information. And then the claim, of course, is that not all the information was returned. And if it could be proven that it was deliberately not returned, and perhaps that he was sharing some of this information, which, maybe, because we also have to wonder what made the FBI think that information hadn't been returned. And presumably something gave them a heads up that the returns were incomplete. And again, they'd need evidence that that was deliberate,
right?
That wasn't just Trump's kind of cavalier attitude towards these sorts of considerations. And I want to have confidence that the Justice Department would not try and prosecute without an airtight case against the former president, against one of his attorneys, against people that have worked for him on this. But as you can tell, I don't have the degree of confidence that I would like to have, given recent years and track record of high profile political controversies like this.
And again, we're speaking with Jonathan Adler, Case Western Reserve Law Professor, Volokh Conspiracy Contributor at Reason.com, at JAdler1969, by the way, on Twitter, at JAdler1969. Jonathan, this brings me, I think, to a broader point, right, which is how much trust and credibility does the FBI and the Department of Justice have after the last 6 or 7 years of of leaks, of half cases being made public. I mean, this is part of the issue here, is that it almost seems like this is a needless escalation that damages a credibility that's already damaged. And the response to the criticism of saying you're fueling attacks, you should stop criticizing us because you're fueling the threats that are coming to FBI offices and agents. I mean, that's almost it's very strange. It's a very strange thing to hear from your government, right? Stop yes. criticizing us because you're on the side of the domestic terrorists if you do.
Yes, I mean, I think the FBI has had several black eyes over the last several years, and there's not been a lot of evidence of people being held accountable for missteps, for allowing political views to influence investigations and the like. And that means they don't have the credibility. And there are things like, what happened with Trump's passports? Did they have them? Did they not have them? Which may have an innocent explanation, but that requires being a bit more forthcoming and acknowledging when missteps were made or when information wasn't communicated, not, as you note, criticizing the fact that people are criticizing you. That's not something that government officials should take. I think at this point we don't know enough to know whether or not the warrant was justified, although I suspect it was, and whether or not a prosecution would be justified. And there, I just don't know. I mean, again, the question that I want to know is after one tranche of documents was returned, what made the Justice Department aware of the fact that not every relevant document had been returned? And that, I think, is key to understanding how justified these actions were. And who knows if we'll know that. Maybe the judge will release the affidavit later this week.
Jonathan Adler, Case Western Reserve law professor, one of the smart commentators on these issues. Great to have him with us. At @JAdler1969 on Twitter. Follow him there.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.